Hey guys, thanks so much for watching these sermons. We hear great stories from all over the world of how Village Church's ministry is affecting you guys and teaching you about Jesus and inspiring you. So that's super inspiring for us. We love that. We would love you to get involved as well. This is villagechurch.com/give. Is a way that you can support the ministry financially. Obviously, everything we do has a lot of costs. The best staff in the world try to use the technology that we can to reach as many people and as many places in the world as we can. So that helps in a huge way. And then this is villagechurch.com/groups is a way that you can actually get engaged in a community group and get invested a little bit deeper into everything that we do in the family aspect of what it means to actually be the church together. So glad you're watching this teachings. Hopefully you guys have a great week and hopefully you see you next week.
Welcome to Village Church. My name's Chris, and I'm one of the lead pastors here at Village Church. Really excited to continue in the book of John with you. And as we continue in the book of John, it's really important that to recognize that we're turning a corner in the text. We're turning a corner to when things start to become increasingly hostile towards Jesus and his ministry. This is a moment in time where we see things start to turn on their heads and see people actually start to confront Jesus about the things he's saying. We recognize that this has already happened back in chapter 5, that in Judea, there were the religious elites who were actually setting out to already kill and murder Jesus because of the things he said. Jesus said he was actually of the same authority of the God they worshiped, but they knew God. They knew the Torah, they knew the rules, they knew the law, they knew everything about who God was from what they were given, and they were saying, yes, there will be a Messiah coming, but they didn't expect that Messiah to be Jesus. And then in this same passage, we see the same thing happening. And so I'm going to read it out to you. But as we read and as we discuss the text today, starting in chapter 7, it's important that you put a frame on this. With this turning page, we see Jesus becoming really intentional about the things he does with his time and how he says them. As people put pressures on him to do or to act a certain way, Jesus pushes back on these things because he's being intentional about the things he's doing. You can tell he's passionate about the right things. He's passionate about actually achieving the mission from which he was sent, that God the Father sent him here to actually accomplish something. And he's not just walking about flagrantly getting it done, but he's being really intentional with his steps. You might see this in other people's lives as well. As people mature in their life, and it's not with everybody who gets old, I'm talking about maturity, you find that a certain peace and steadiness comes to rest in that person. They learn to be passionate about the right things. Not that they're just apathetic about the things that they don't care about, but they start to care about the right things. And so they're able to let other things go. And this is important because we see this in Jesus' life, but it's not tied to his life experience. It's tied more deeply to a relationship with God the Father. And that's something that I want all of us to move towards. So read this and think on this and meditate on this passage through that lens. It says, after this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go into Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of the booths was at hand. So his brother said to him, leave here and go to Judea that your disciples may see the works that you're doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, my time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I'm not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come. After saying this, he remained in Galilee, but after his brothers had gone up to the feast, he then also went up, but not publicly, but in private. The Jews were looking for him at the feast, saying, where is he? And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said he's a good man, others said, no, he's leading people astray. Yet for the fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly about him. And so we get this picture. We get this picture that Jesus now is walking about in Galilee, a place where he actually did most of his ministry. For the last year, Jesus has been in Galilee doing his ministry, living out his life in this area, and now he's heading back to Judea. We just came out of chapter 6 where we see people actually turning from their faith and their fellowship of Jesus, where you have these disciples who actually leave him based on what he says. And we find even here a conflict about who Jesus says he is and what he's actually about. We see all this conflict about how he's entering into a culture and he's actually hated by a culture because of what he speaks about the culture. We see people muttering about him who believe he's good, who believe he's not good. We see all of these brothers, his brothers who have these opinions on him. And we're going to find that Jesus and his words are the things that are tied together and unified. And that might actually even create conflict for us internally as to how we follow him. And so he's not going into Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. We have people who are now out to get Jesus in this hostile environment from which they want to actually end his ministry and his life because he's speaking radical things. Jesus is not just speaking niceties into a culture that needs to hear and learn how to be nice to their neighbors, who need to learn how to love each other better, who need to learn how to stop hurting each other and inflicting pain on one another and doing these sinful things that all hurt the regular, interactive, experiential life things. Jesus is actually saying something so much more. He's actually talking about who he is in relationship to God the Father, and we see a practical outpouring of that relationship in these texts, and he's not heading into Judea because the people who are going to kill him. But in Judea, there's something really exciting happening. This is actually a really joyful time for the community that Jesus is entering into, and this is called the Feast of Booths. Now, the Feast of Booths is one of three pilgrimages that happen with the Jewish faith where they celebrate different ways that God was providential in their lives, right? So we have Passover, we have the day of Pentecost, we have the actual moment of the Feast of Booths, and this is where they're celebrating God's providence for Israel when they were in the wilderness. This is their forefathers, and they're remembering the goodness of God. There's all these different things that would happen. Townships and families would gather, and they'd all go to the temple in Jerusalem together. They'd all spend time there in the temple. The temple would actually light up these huge jars of oil at night to actually show how God was providential in actually guiding them by a pillar of fire at night, a pillar of smoke by day, back in the time of the Israelites when they were in the Exodus, in the wilderness. And as he guided them, so now the temple shines brightly. It was so bright, in fact, this huge temple with all these cauldrons of oil that like every corner of Jerusalem was lit up. It just had this glow. This is how bright this was. And it's to remember that. The priest would come out from the temple and actually pick up water and bring it back up to the altar and pour it on the stones of the altar to represent this moment where God was gracious and providential, took care of his people when he was able to give water through stones and, hey, strike this stone with your staff, boom, that would happen. And then water would flow for his people to be sustained. This is a beautiful picture. Think about it for families where you would take your family, you'd come live in this little lean-to booth that you would create with your family for 8 days. Two of them would be rested. The rest would be celebration, and you would live together, and you'd be able to tell your kids and remember and reflect on the goodness of God in your life. And like, if there's something we as evangelical Christians today, or if you're exploring Jesus, or if you have him in your life, you don't find yourself to be religious and you're at home watching and you just like to kind of consume content, like how often are we placed into a period of reflection like this festival puts them in? It's like, there are things that God has done providentially in your life that I would encourage you to reflect on. And maybe if you can't tend to remember those things because you're like me and you like to be future focused and you're always moving forward and things, maybe it's a good practice to even pick up journaling. It's to actually read through your own accounts and experiences of how God has shown up in your life and then take time to reflect on those. Maybe on a birthday, like just take 10, 15 minutes, an hour even, to just sit and reflect on what God has done to bring you where you were, all the fears, all the hardships, all the things he's brought you through. Because then I think as you start to head into harder things, it can remind you of the goodness and the presence of God. That's what this festival was about. The goodness and the presence of God and the things that have happened in the past to encourage them for the things that will happen in the future. Now, is Jesus just going to head right up there? Let's just see what happens next. So Jesus' brothers say to him next, "Leave here and go to Judea that your disciples may see the works you're doing." And this is such an interesting passage because we learn a big thing that Jesus had brothers. We don't get to hear a lot about his family. I mean, we just think of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and that's their family unit. But this is actually saying, no, Jesus has brothers. In fact, the text also will tell us that he actually had sisters as well. We know his brothers are named. He has Judas, not the one who betrays him. We have Simon, not Simon Peter. We have we also have Joseph, right? So like Joe Jr. And then we have his brother James. And what we learn about them here is that they actually have a great deal of care for their brother and a great deal of wisdom. Like, these are people who in the last like 30 so-ish years have lived with Jesus and know Jesus really, really well. So what do his brothers say to him? How does this impact what Jesus does? So his brothers say to him, "Leave here, go to Judea that your disciples may see the works you're doing." That sounds fair enough. "For no one who works in secret if he seeks to be known openly." So they get that Jesus was growing his ministry up until this point, even in Galilee, Jesus was growing his ministry. He had followers. He had disciples. His brothers saw this 6 months ago, this time that had passed, because we started in chapter 6, we were in springtime. Now we're in the fall time. In that 6 months, they've seen how even his ministry had actually shrunk, like disciples left based on what Jesus was saying. "But for no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly." So they're saying, hey, go and actually make much of yourself. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. But what's this here, this next line? "For not even his brothers believed in him." We learn that there's actually a contrast. So they want what's best for Jesus and his ministry, but they don't actually believe him. They don't believe in him to be God. These are people who have been with him for years and years and years, and they don't believe in him to be God. Now, Why is it that Jesus' brothers are coming to Jesus and saying, leave here and go to Judea, where we know this huge festival is happening, thousands of people coming into one place. There's going to be a huge spectacle. There's lots of people here. We know Judea, even from chapter 5, to be this place of the religious elites, where people in Judea are the ones who know the law, who know God, who are like the ones who are conflicting against Jesus and his teachings. And they say, go to Judea. Why? So that your disciples also may see the works you're doing. They say, don't hide out anymore, Jesus. Go here. And this is actually really important because it's more than just Judea being the center of religious hub. In that time, when Jews were thinking of a Messiah, they didn't think of a Messiah just as a Messiah who's coming to save and reconcile them to God, to the Father, because of their sin. They already had a system for that. They had a temple system where they could sacrifice things on the altar and bring about this reconciliation through their own acts. They had a religious system that made the way for them to be in connection with God, but it was imperfect because they're imperfect. They actually also believed that currently the Jews are under the oppression of Rome, that this would be a political Messiah, that Jesus would be more than just a Messiah for salvation, for their souls, for things that are connecting, that he would make a real world difference in the political stature of the Jewish people. He would relieve them from the pressures of Rome and put them back in their rightful standing as powers and authorities in the world that they're living in. This is an interesting thing to just think about for a second, because in this, we're not seeing Jesus' brothers celebrated here as being given all the right worldly wisdom for Jesus to take, because Jesus goes on to say, no, I'm not going to do that. He has a different plan. We see that these brothers are saying, I think that you should actually accomplish what we want you to accomplish in the world through our politics, through what we believe you should accomplish as Messiah. If you're really the one you say you are, Jesus, if you're not just our brother that we've known for 30 some odd years and gotten to know everything about, if you're not just that annoyingly perfect brother, then would you go and be the Messiah that we'd hoped you'd be? Go to the middle of the center. Like, don't just live in the backwoods of Galilee and make all this like kind of these waves out here as to who you are. Go to the center, political hub, the place where everything happens, and take over the politics of the day and make something happen there. Are you living your relationship today like this? Are you building your expectations on who you think Jesus should be based into the politics of what you're living? Right now is a volatile time to be on any side of a political spectrum. But what I'm more heartbroken in seeing is not the division between people around politics, but the lack of affection that we're speaking towards who Jesus is. It's like we're trying to syncretistically bring the worldview of how we love and live in politics, our best practices, experiences, the things we've read, the things we know, the ways we know better. And we're trying to jam Jesus into the middle of that system and use him to also actually leverage our political gains and values. You know, this isn't something that's new to anybody. In fact, in Mere Christianity, this is an incredible book. For some of you who may be just becoming Christians or even thinking about Christianity, this is a book I'd so encourage you to read. But there's a quote around this that C.S. Lewis actually talks about that I think is really pertinent to this idea of what the expectations Jesus' brothers had for him means for Jesus' application of ministry in the world, and also for us as we live out as Christians in the world trying to make much of Jesus. It says, the ordinary idea which we all have before we become Christians is this. We take as the starting point our ordinary self with its various desires and interests. Then we admit that something else, call it morality or decent behavior or the good of society, has claims on this self, claims that interfere with its own desires. What we mean by being good is giving into those claims, that some of the things the ordinary self wanted to do that we call right, well, we should have to do them. But we're hoping at the same time that when all the demands have been met, the poor natural self will have some chance and some time to get on with its own life and do what it likes. In fact, we're very much like an honest man paying his taxes. He pays them all right, but he does hope that there'll be some enough left over for him to live on, because we are all still taking our natural self as the starting point. In our relationship with Jesus, as individuals before him, if we're not placing our identity in who Jesus is, if we're not starting our starting point as being people now who have been redeemed by the blood of Christ, people now who live under the authority of Jesus, people now who are defined by the love of Christ in our lives and how we love others, like if we don't define our love for others based on the love that Christ has given us, then we quickly fall into this political divide where we start putting expectations on Jesus and how his life and his love should be shown to the world. It's no longer Jesus as a starting point, it's us as the starting point, hoping that we still can be ourselves in the midst of our Christianity when Jesus has so much more for us. He says, I have a deeper thing for you. And this is what his brothers wanted. His brothers wanted Jesus to do what they desired him to do. And it sounds like good wisdom. It says, for no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. They say, Jesus, we want you to be known. We want you to be known to the world. If you want to be known, this is the way to do it. You need to go about it this way. You see, if you do these things, show yourself to the world. It's like, again, show yourself Jesus. But his brothers don't have this basis, this foundation, this central belief in who Jesus is as God. And so I encourage you, if you are professing Jesus as Lord of your life and you're spending more time talking about and persuading and trying to increase the value of your political stream into the lives of others, what you care about, what you think, what you want, and you're spending less time building your affections for Jesus and building your love up for him and trying to woo people onto Jesus, then I feel like you're missing the point. And I'm not just talking about like social media feeds, which are easy to see. I'm talking about your quiet conversations, the time when you're just with friends. Are you groaning and bellyaching and gossiping and spending time around what other people believe and how people are acting in the world and what they're doing? Or are you taking time to build each other's affections in Christ so that you don't fall prey to the same thing Jesus' brothers did, where they spent a whole lot of time wasting and running their thoughts around what Jesus should be doing and what should be moved when they didn't build their belief in him? And we kind of know some of the story of who Jesus' brothers turned out to be, which we'll get into later, but you're gonna find there's a turn. As you get closer to understand Jesus is God and as you build your affections for him, things in your life start to change. And so again, I just wanna encourage you, if that's you, getting caught up in the midst of everything that's going on and not taking the time to build your affection for Jesus and build other people's affections around you for Jesus and move people closer to Jesus, then you're missing the point. And I think you're missing a window in this time that God is giving us to increase his value in the world, where instead you're taking all that time to increase other values that you might have, right or wrong. It's not based in him, because not even his brothers believed. And so Jesus said to them, he said, I actually have something deeper. He said, my time has not yet come. Jesus seems to have information that his brothers don't. But your time is always here, he's saying to his brothers. There's something else. Like, he's operating on a different sovereign timeline than they are. This is that kind of thing where it's like, God has a different plan in the midst of what we might think is best for our lives than even we might know. He actually has these things outside of time. Like, we might go through trials and tribulations and all these things, but Jesus is operating on a different timeline, both in his life here and in your life today. And so there's a deep encouragement in the midst of this text for us. It's that when Jesus says that his time has not yet come, we get this understanding that God has a sovereign timeline about life and about things that are happening that might be beyond our control and might be beyond our understanding. He has other information. You know, I went on this missions trip to Greece a couple of years ago, and I went with this incredible team. And after our trip, we were working on the island of Lesbos in this refugee camp. And afterwards, we had one day layover in Athens. And so we all had plans of what we were going to do that day. We had plans to go and spend time to see the Areopolis, to go and actually see everything that was happening in Athens, spend time searching and researching, finding things. And we were looking all about what we could do. So the day starts. So we actually, just before we take the flight from Lesbos to Athens, which is like 30 minutes, it's like literally you hop up in the air and then you're landing again, we actually have to return the cars. And so before we returned the cars, we had a good purse of money left over that we didn't spend when we were out there. And we gave that to the missionaries, the long-term missionaries who were there with us. And then we go and return the cars, and these missionaries were going to drive us to the airport. And we find that as we return the cars, the guy who's like getting the cars back, he's like, no, you guys, like, you've damaged these cars. There's like scrapes here and a dent here. And in like, because driving in Lesbos is a whole, like, it's the Wild West out there. You're taking corners, you're turning things, parking spots are tight. Like, it's not this North American, like, big car driving. You get the smallest car you can just so you can fit into the places you need to. These roads, these cobblestone roads are just so small. And so we ended up being like these North American drivers who totally ruined these cars. And now we're at this point where we don't have money now to pay for the cars to return, but we have to pay for them before we can go and catch our flight, which we're already late for. And so I have this really humbling moment where I actually have to take the money that from the mission that I gave to the missionaries back so I can pay the guy the car money so that we can have those cars because he needed it in cash. And so then so that's like the first thing that went wrong. So then we get onto the airplane, we fly over. And then the next thing that goes wrong is as we're taking a tram into Athens, two of the people on our team's passports get stolen. They get pickpocketed on the tram. So now this whole flight, like they might be stuck in Athens because they're not able to make that international flight back to Canada at this point. And so they have to figure this out. So two people from our team now are in the embassy and they're trying to work out their passports because now we're on an 8-hour time limit to get there. And then, so one of the things we wanted to do as a group is we wanted to go to Mars Hill. It's the section where like Paul in Acts 17 actually speaks, preaches the gospel. And we wanted to read the account of Paul on Acts Hill in person. And we go there and like, as soon as we start reading Acts 17, like this windstorm just picks up like crazy. Like I'm talking like crazy. Like it's blowing around. I'm yelling Acts 17 over it. And we just can't even barely hear what's happening. And I'm like, man, that didn't go out the way I planned. And so all through this day, we have these three major points where things don't work out. And then we get this view in retrospect afterwards of how much better it was that it didn't work out to our plans, but it worked out to God's plans. Like this moment with the where I had to take the money back was this humbling moment that actually built a relationship with this person who was a long-term missionary in Greece, who's now actually a pastor on our team here. There's this other moment where these two passports were actually taken from them and they got to see the goodness of God and how he worked through the embassy and actually placed this Christian woman there who was willing to help and make all these things connect so that they were able to get back home on time. And then Acts 17, this like storm, like it could have been this little anticlimactic moment, but it felt like we were like fighting off nature to be like read the gospel out loud on this moment it happened as we look over the temple of Zeus in one corner and the Areopagus up in the top. And it's like all these things that are happening around us. It's like this actually became a profound moment that moved us closer to Jesus. And you see, Jesus is about his glory in the midst of this text. He's not looking to just glorify his ministry. He's looking to glorify himself. He's not looking to get followers so people will follow him and like him and say the right things in the right places. He's looking to actually save the world and pay for sin and effectively execute the mission by which he was called, by which he came to earth to succeed at. He's being really intentional with his time, and so he will be with you. In a practical way, you might be living in something right now where you're just waiting on God to show up. You're saying, God, this isn't my timeline. Like, I thought I'd be married by now. I thought I'd have kids by now. I thought I'd have a whole lot more life left. And it looks like you've given me years, maybe months. Like I walked through these pastoral moments with you. Like, God, I thought I was going to have babies by now. And now I'm waiting and going through this hardship. And like I have friends that I'm praying for, family members I'm praying for, that they would just get pregnant. And this timeline isn't theirs. You have moments where it's like you had plans for school and you had plans for outings, you had plans for vacations, the big things, the small things. You had all these plans and now like it feels like the world's been flipped upside down and those plans are gone. The question is not, will you get the plans that you wanted? The question is, are you willing to follow Jesus and trust him in his plans? You might believe now in the power of God, but are you also willing to believe in and trust in the plan he has for you? Will you let your trust build there? And so we have this time when Jesus is saying, my time has not yet come, but your time is always here. He continues because he knows what's going on. He knows that people are out to get him out in Jerusalem. He says, the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that its works are evil. We're going to come back to that because he continues with his brothers. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to the feast for my time has not yet fully come. After saying this, he remained in Galilee. He's just operating on a different plane of existence built in the relationship he has with God the Father. He's sitting in that trust. He's sitting and he's waiting in that trust. Catherine of Genoa was this like woman who was working well for the gospel in the 1400s. And she had this like beautiful life of serving other people, but more than just a life of application that she had a relationship with God the Father that I think exudes this. And I just want to read an excerpt from her life that she talks about as far as what it looks like to live in that relationship. It says, God gives us his light in an instant, allowing us to know all that we need to know. But no more is given to us than that is necessary in his plan to lead us to perfection. We cannot seek this light. It's given to us from God only as he chooses. Neither do we know how it comes or even how do we know what it is. If we try to know more than what we have been made to know, we will accomplish nothing. We simply wait like a stone with no capacity until he brings us life. Therefore, I will not weary myself with seeking beyond what God wants me to know. Instead, I'll abide in peace with the understanding God has given me. and I will let this occupy my mind. If we're to see properly, we must pluck out of our eyes our own presumption. If we gaze too long at the sun, we go blind. In this manner, I think, does pride blind many of us who want to know too much. When God finds a soul, listen to this, when God finds a soul that rests in him and is not easily moved, that means like not moved by the trials of the time, that's not easily moved, he operates within it in his own manner. That soul allows God to do great things within it. He gives to such a soul the key to the treasures he's prepared for it, that it might enjoy them. And to the same soul, he gives the joy of his presence, which entirely absorbs it. Like this is the like, entirely absorbs such a soul. This is the tying in that we see Jesus in this perfect relationship with God the Father. He says like, tie into me. In John 17, in the midst of his prayer, he prays this. He prays that his people would be one the same way he and the Father are one, that like he is the second person of the Trinity of God the Father, God the Son, that's Jesus, and God the Spirit. And you have this tying in where the three of them uniquely become one. And you see it play out in Jesus' life where he's feeling the pressure of both his ministry waning, the people in his life saying, Jesus, this is the way you should go. There's real good worldly wisdom in this. And then you have Jesus saying, no, it's not my time to go. I'm not going up to the feast. This is not my time to be there. My time has not yet fully come. He's like so in tune with the Father that he walks in peace despite the challenges and the pressures around him. He knows what he needs to do to accomplish it. And the question is for us, are we pursuing a closeness with Jesus that gives us a peace in the midst of the pressures of life to live functionally in the path that God has designed for us? To recognize that in his timing, we can trust, we can have peace, we can abide with him. We don't need to try and push and rush things our own way. It's not that we sit idle because we're about to see Jesus does take action, but there's a principle here where we can still, in our affections building for Jesus, learn to trust him in ways that would allow our timeline to become his timeline, that would allow our trust to reflect the trust that Jesus has in his Father, even in a hostile and a growing hostility of environment around him. So then we also have this one verse to deal with here in the middle of it. Because the world, he says, the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. Now we're about to see this play out in the actual people that Jesus is going to actually speak to, the people that are at this feast. Remember, this is a feast about providence. This is a feast about like people celebrating the goodness and the presence of God in their lives, and yet they have God incarnate with them and they don't even recognize it. And they're starting to talk about what Jesus teaches about. It says, Jesus says, the world hates me because of what I say to it. The world hates me because of how I bring conviction to it. The world hates me because of how I confront it. Jesus is not just a neutral player who's encouraging people to be loving. Jesus is actually someone who brings radical ideas and lifestyle. He's tied to his words. I believe this is why John, at the beginning of this book, where he's writing something very intentionally for us to know something about Jesus, starts by saying, the word became flesh. Like this is the idea that Jesus and his words are uniquely intertwined. You cannot say that you love the person of Jesus without understanding and saying that you love the things that he said, because the things that he said are the person who he is. And this happens sometimes. Some of you who don't actually follow Jesus with your life, or try to actually say you're a Christian or try to understand him or know him, but see him as a good philosopher or a good someone, a historical person who has great ideas of loving your neighbor. Like that's actually just not Jesus. You have learned or you have built or you have tried to understand a Jesus that isn't actually biblically him. It's not in any of the accounts him. And I wonder if you came to know and love Jesus or follow him or think about him or understand him, if you sat down maybe with the problem of Jesus that Pastor Mark wrote and you read it, if you would actually find things that you found valuable, if you would actually contest the things that Jesus said. Like it's not just a person you can be okay with. Jesus is claiming to be God. You see, because we see this play out even here. After his brothers gone up to the feast, so his brothers do move up to the feast, Jesus stays back and then in his timing, he decides to go. He also went up, but not publicly. Jesus stayed in private. Jesus stayed, secretly went up and started to see what was happening around there. He went quietly into the midst of this big temple, completely contrasting what his brothers had said would be best practice for him He went quietly. He didn't go up to overthrow monarchies, to be the biggest political voice, to get his political party in power, to actually have that kind of authority. He didn't do that. He wasn't the political Messiah everybody thought he would be in the time. He came up quietly, humbly, and he went in private. But the Jews were looking for him at the feast, right? So people expected Jesus to come. They knew that everybody was coming to this festival. They knew everybody was coming. They expected Jesus to be there. So they're looking for him at the feast and saying, "Where is he?" Now, this is interesting because his brothers are already there. They know Jesus' brothers are here at the feast. They know his family. They know his town. They're looking for him and they want to find Jesus. And how does everybody respond? Well, in the midst of them not finding him immediately, there was much muttering about him among the people. People were talking about this person of Jesus. He was the talk of the town. Not explicitly people saying things, but like people are actually talking earnestly, understanding, trying to know who is Jesus and what's he doing. Listen to what they said about him, because this is supremely interesting. Some of them said, "He's a good man." While others said, "No, he's leading the people astray." And so you have these very two clear, unique camps that are actually talking about who Jesus is. They're making judgments upon who the person of Jesus is. And in the midst of it, the judgments they're making are around his character. Some are saying he's a good man, and some people are saying he's leading others astray. Are either of these statements true? Is Jesus a good man, or is Jesus leading people astray? You might find yourself in one of these two camps. You might find yourself believing, actually, Jesus is a good man. He did preach love your neighbor as yourself. He did heal the sick. He did help people. He seemed to be someone who had this care for the people and this compassion. Like, he would heal people as he walked through. He'd spend time. He'd spend time with the people who were lower than, less than. He didn't just try and build a name for himself, but he tried to build other people up. He's a good man. And then some of you say, no, he is leading people astray. Jesus is this man who's actually like crazy. Like, he's telling people that he's the only way to God the Father. And it's interesting because the real only valid statement here is the second one. The most valid statement of the two is that he's leading people astray. That's the only one that really makes sense. You can't look at the teachings and person of Jesus and say that he's just a good man. He's not. He claims to be God. If anything, he's not just good, he's crazy. Like, he's saying these things and he's trying to heal people. He's doing these miracles. Like, you don't just get to walk around and say you're a good man, but also say you're God. Those things are not compatible with one another. The most valid statement that's being said about him is that he may be leading people astray if they don't believe the claims that he's making. And so if you find yourself in a place where you just think he's a good man, that's not going far enough. He's not just a good man, he's God. And that's the claim Jesus was making. He never claimed just to be a good man. Was he perfectly man? Yes. Was he perfect man? Yes. Did he ever sin? No. But he's fully God. And this ties into exactly what Jesus is trying to accomplish here. He's trying to move people from seeing him as a good man who holds good values. He's trying to move people from seeing him as someone who's maybe leading people astray from the Jewish faith. He's saying, no, I'm more than that. He's like, I am here to reconcile you to God the Father. I am here to solve the sin problem of the world. I am here to live a perfect life that none of us could. I'm here now in this hostile environment to move towards my murder where I will be killed on your behalf. Like, I will be killed in your place. I will take on all of your sin, all of your shame, all of your guilt, all of your wrong placements, all of your wrong opinions and motivations, all of those things. I am sitting in a place with God the Father where I will complete the mission of dying for those sins so you can be reconciled to him. And this is how he displayed his great love for us. This is what Jesus is trying to accomplish. He's more than a good man. He's not leading people astray. He's coming in to change the trajectory and the futures of humanity. And yet, for the fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly about him. You see, there's this moment now. People are speaking about Jesus in private, but they're not speaking openly about him. A lot of these people who maybe even thought he was good, they haven't yet taken the step to say he was God. This is Jesus' brothers. This is where Jesus' brothers are. But they had a question before him because of how Jesus contrasted all the thoughts about him in society. You know, theologian and pastor, subpar golf player and movie reviewer Mark Clark wrote this in The Problem of Jesus. He says, "With so many options available to a faithful and concerned Jewish person, Jesus' ministry did what all good prophetic ministries do. It subverted the stories, beliefs, and actions of these movements and replaced them with something better. Jesus' vision offered both prophetic critique and prophetic hope that it supplanted the others. Jesus and his kingdom message were unique in the marketplace of ideas, and that scandalous uniqueness proved deadly for him. Jesus knew that his words would actually be met with this conflicting understanding. Jesus knew that as he spoke and as he taught, some people would view him as good and not God. Jesus knew as he spoke and he taught, some people would view him as misleading. Jesus knew as he spoke and he taught, as he lived alongside his brothers, that they would not believe in him in that time. And you're sitting here in this place now where it's like we see all of these things happening, but we also know the hope that Jesus offered to the future, because those who did not speak openly of him, even his brothers, one day did. They one day did. James went on to actually write the book of James and to lead the church in Jerusalem. Judas actually went on to write the book of Jude. Like, his brothers came to know Jesus and follow him as God, not just as a brother who they could put their opinions on, but actually as the God of the universe and who he said he was. There's this radical moment, and we're seeing the backside of this where we see, like, nobody spoke of him. Nobody spoke openly of him. His brothers didn't speak openly of him. The other people, they lived in fear of the people around him and weren't willing to speak openly about who he was, but that changed radically. Why? Because Jesus offered a new level of hope in who he was. We're gonna see Jesus' ministry all through this, the gospel of what he's doing, the things he's accomplishing. All of it is crucial that his teachings portray him to be God, not just a good man. His teachings portray him to be infinitely like connected with God the Father, that he is actually perfectly one with him. And so we knew to see this new relativity of time, how he actually works within time, how he pushes back against the constraints and lives out his life in a way that accomplishes the mission of going to the cross to take on all the sin of the world. The things that you've done wrong and the things that I've done wrong. And so my hope for you is this, that if you're sitting in a place where you believe that Jesus is a good man, that you might actually move further and see him as God, that you would see his teachings, not just about, like, it's not good enough just to sit there and think he's a good man, because we see here in the text that people wanted to kill him based on his teachings. He wasn't just good. If you feel that Jesus is leading people astray, you feel like that maybe, like, you know what? He's causing people to be brainwashed. He's brainwashing people. He's constantly pushing people, like, across the line. He's saying things that are countercultural. It's not good, his teachings. They're not as inclusive enough. It's like, recognize that Jesus is actually trying to do this for all people, even the people who don't believe. And just another word of hope in the midst of this. You may have family members in your life that you've been preaching the gospel to nonstop, that you've been trying to teach and love and learn and hope that they fall in love with Jesus. Jesus' brothers went through that same struggle, the ones who actually got to live with Jesus and get to know Jesus, that they didn't believe in him for a period of time, but one day they did. I'm really thankful for the book of John. I'm really thankful that we're gonna be able to walk through it more together, that we're gonna get to see Jesus' ministry unfold even in a hostile environment. We're gonna see what Jesus does at the Festival of Booths and what it actually turned out to be when he showed up. He showed up quietly, but he showed up. What did that do to that festival? What did it do to the people there? And what does a text like this give us the opportunity to reflect in how we love others, in how we preach Jesus, in how we view him, and how we accept him as Lord and Savior of our life? And so I encourage you to take that step today. If you do not know Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior, you don't love him and follow him with your life, today might be the day where you take a step into that relationship, where you put your opinions on the side and say, I actually want to start with you as the center of my life, Jesus. And I pray that you would take that step today. And so I'm just going to pray for us as we close, but I thank you, Jesus, for this word. Father, I thank you so much that you sent Jesus to earth, that you gave him this opportunity to be amongst us. And in this passage, we get to see a closeness with you and a way that his life and his practice of his life changed because of that relationship. Thank you so much that you love us and you give us the opportunity to know you more, Jesus. And I pray that we would come to follow you, not just as a good man, but as God. That we put our sidelines and our beliefs aside and we begin to trust you in the waiting, and that you would supremely and with all authority give us the opportunity to know who you are fully so that we could build our affections and our love for you, Jesus. And I pray this in your beautiful and powerful name. Amen.